And now, a special feature we call Molecular Biology 101. For ancient oncology fossils like myself, the complex schematics of intracellular pathways I see presented at meetings sometimes seem like a bunch of gibberish that seems unrelated to patient care, but clearly targeted agents focusing on pieces of this puzzle are increasing in frequency, and all oncologists must understand the basics of how these pathways can be interrupted with the hope of improving patient outcomes and maybe eliminating this disease. I met with Dr. Lisa Carey and Dr. Jenny Chang, two investigators who are in the middle of the targeted revolution, and asked them to update us on where we are and where we're headed. Dr. Carey began by commenting on the groundbreaking genomic classification system developed by her colleague at the University of North Carolina, Dr. Charles Perreault.
When we talk about molecular classifications of breast cancers, we have to sort of decide what we're trying to classify. So the work that I've been mostly involved with Chuck really is unsupervised kind of classifications, what we call the intrinsic profiles or, you know, intrinsic gene list for breast cancers, which tells you differences between breast cancers but doesn't tell you anything about how they behave. Some of the work that other people, including Jenny, have been involved with is classifying tumors according to their outcome. So that's a supervised kind of analysis. It's still molecular, but it's different. The recurrence score is an example of that, the 70-gene prognosticator. So if you're asking the question, which is what Chuck has done when he was at Stanford first and then subsequently, and several other groups have replicated this kind of effort, are there differences between breast cancers? It's a very simple question, has nothing to do with how they were treated, and it has nothing to do with their prognosis. And it turns out, of course, as you know, that there are molecular portraits of breast cancers that differ from one type to another. And there's at least five, and frankly, probably more. But there are the five that we talk about most commonly, the two luminal subtypes, luminal A and luminal B, the basal-like subtype, the HER2, what we now call the HER2 positive ER negative subtype. And the reason the nomenclature changed a little bit is to try and reduce confusion with clinical HER2 testing, which of course picks up both ER positive and negative subtypes. In molecular profiling, the HER2 subtype is really the ER negative group only. And then a sort of unclassifiable group really that's called the normal-like type, probably because there was too much stroma involved to really categorize them effectively. Those profiles have been replicated in multiple independent data sets. And as I said, they exist regardless of treatment and outcome, which is not to say that they don't have prognostic implications. They do, and that's also been shown in multiple independent data sets. But if there was no prognostic relevance of these subtypes, it wouldn't change their value at all. I don't think they're the best way to prognosticate. They weren't developed for prognostication. Their value is in their ability to biologically define different groups, really basically the different diseases sort of under the umbrella of what we call breast cancer. So those are the intrinsic profiles, the molecular profiles.
Jenny, can you comment?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that the molecular classification, as Lisa has rightly pointed out, just tells you the different subtypes of breast cancer. For me, what would be interesting is, do these come from the same cell of origin? Can they go from one to the other? And that would be another totally different question. But in terms of, as we know, breast cancer, there are five broad categories and probably more, especially perhaps in the triple negative groups, there may be more than just the basal type, and there may be different types within that. But as we have it, there are five types. And from a cell of origin point of view, it would be interesting to see whether they all come from a single cell of origin or different cells of origin. And we don't know that.
Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, Jenny's absolutely right. So the future for us, if we can think of these as pretty crude, low-hanging fruit in terms of profiling, there's almost certainly going to be much more thoughtful subtypes within subtypes. I think of it like a tree. We're at the first level of branching, and then each branch will then have its own set. It is, I think, important to point out that there isn't a huge gross alteration in profile, at least as far as we know, over the course of the natural history of an individual breast cancer. And there's some evidence from this that was published last year in Cancer Research where they looked at primary tumors, and also they had a few samples where they had the primary tumor, the nodal met, and in another group they had the primary tumor and distant mets, both synchronous and metachronous, including some from, I think Laura Vandeveer had some that were 20 years later or 15 years later or some, you know, years down the road. The subtypes, those tumors still clustered next to each other. So tumors from the same woman ended up next to each other. They didn't get separated and they didn't change classification, which is not to say that they didn't change their nature. They almost certainly had alterations in their genes that were expressed. But in the list of genes that separate one category of breast cancer from another category of breast cancer, they don't change grossly from, say, a basal-like to a HER2, for example.
Can you explain a little bit more about exactly how Dr. Peru went about doing this research and a little bit more about the classification of the five different subtypes and clinically what we know about them?
Dr. Peru did his postdoctoral work in the Brown and Botstein lab at Stanford, which is sort of the lab that developed these techniques in tissue-based samples, really certainly for solid tumors, and was the most famous in this in the 10 years ago or so. And the seminal paper on this particular topic was a co-first authored paper between Chuck Peru and Therese Sorley. And in that, they did essentially what it sounds like. I think it was called Molecular Portraits of Breast Cancer at some point was how they termed them. And they asked a very simple question. If you take a lot of genes in a gene expression array, can you identify a subset of those genes that seem to be more altered between one group of breast cancers and another group of breast cancers? And is breast cancer a range of different diseases with each one looking a little different than the other? Or are there identifiable clusters? And that, of course, is clustering analysis that was performed on these to try and identify whether there were groups of breast cancers. And they started with a relatively small data set. It was fewer than 100 samples of breast cancers. And they separated them. It's actually interesting. The way they started was that they asked what genes are the most altered between cancers, but not altered within cancers. And within that data set, they had a group of breast cancers that were before and after neoadjuvant chemotherapy samples from their Norwegian collaborators, as I recall. And so they said, okay, we want the genes that are not changed. We want to get rid of genes that may have changed from the same woman before and after doxorubicin and keep the genes that are the most different between cancers. And using that, they ended up with about 500 genes that filled those criteria. I think it was about fourfold different between one cancer and another and tended to stay the same within a cancer. And that's where the 496 gene, what's called the intrinsic list, comes from. And that intrinsic list has been the gene list that's been applied to other people's data sets. And so in subsequent studies, they looked not only at their own Stanford and Norway data set, but they looked at the Vandeveer data set, the West data set, and several others, and applied their intrinsic gene list to see whether they came up with the same groupings of breast cancers across different data sets, in independent data sets. And they did. And the prognosis that was identified in their original data set in terms of the luminal subtypes tended to do better, but within the two luminal subtypes, there's A and B clearly did worse than A. And then the basal-like and the HER2 subtypes tended to have poorer prognoses. And that was recapitulated in the other data sets also. I think one of the reasons that molecular profiling has become a part of clinicians' lexicon so quickly is that, in a sense, the gene expression profiling mimicked what we already suspected about breast cancer biology, in that these profiles clearly separated an ER-positive group and an ER-negative group. And the very first separation in those clusters is between ER-positive subtypes and ER-negative subtypes. Well, that fits with what clinicians have known for years. So that was, in a sense, reassuring that this wasn't throwing away things that we already knew to be true. It was taking it, what we knew to be true, and extending it, in a sense, with a little more biology. So then you add in the question of HER2. You know, it was also very reassuring, I think, to clinicians that HER2 came out as a biologically distinct group of tumors, as we all know it is. And then you add the additional biologic information. One of the things that comes up a lot is, are these really prognostic profiles? And I think it's very important for people to think about these, not so much as prognostic profiles, but really biologic ones. They may give us information about therapeutically relevant differences, but that's not really what they're there for.
So can you go through the five subtypes and generally what you see in terms of HER2 and ER and other biologic and clinical characteristics?
There's two parts to that. One is in terms of gene expression arrays, there are differences that are characteristic among these subtypes. Luminal A and luminal B are the two ER-positive subtypes. Luminal A tends to have in the ER and ER-regulated genes higher expression of them compared to the luminal Bs, where they're still expression of the ER and related genes, but they tend to be a little lower. HER2-positive, ER-positive breast cancers tend to fall into the luminal B category, which fits with another characteristic of the luminal Bs, which is they tend to have higher expression of the proliferative gene clusters. They usually have relatively few P53 mutations, and those are probably the main characteristics within expression profiling of the luminals.
Why do they call it luminal?
The gene expression pattern that they most resemble from the normal epithelial component is the luminal epithelial cells, which I think Jenny was getting to the question of whether this reflects a cell of origin issue or whether this is simply a similarity with other causes, I think has not been answered, and certainly Jenny can put her scientist hat on and speak more thoughtfully about it than I can. Basal-like similarly has a crude resemblance to the expression pattern of the basal epithelial cells of the breast. These are normal epithelial cells, so that's where the names came from. They weren't really designed to speak to cell of origin specifically. That analysis and that question is raised later.
So what do you see in the basal subtypes and the other two?
Well, the basal, as you know, we call them the triple negative in the clinical scenario because they're typically low for ER and its related genes, and it's low for HER2. So when we do clinical assays, most ER negative, PR negative, HER2 negative breast cancers are in fact basal-like. They're very highly proliferative. The proliferative gene cluster is typically very high in these. They do have, and you know, the basal phenotype, of course, the epithelial components means that there are certain cytokeratins, 5, 6, 17, that are characteristically expressed. And then in addition, as you know, there are a few other characteristic differences. EGFR, HER1 tends to be relatively up in this group, and c-KIT also is part of the basal profile. And then the HER2 is up for the HER2 cluster of genes, so genes that are related to HER2 expression, and typically low in the ER-related genes.
Well, I think that's very interesting. And some work which Craig Ulrich has been doing in our group is that in the same classification holds true for DCIS.
Right.
So looking at the natural evolution of the disease, DCIS too has the same five subgroups. And I think that what Lisa said is very true. I mean, the primary tumor and the metastases, they cluster together. There are differences. I mean, it's a slightly different question if you ask, are there differences between the primary and the metastases? But by and large, if you expression profile a large number of primaries and metastases, the same patient samples will cluster together. So that's extremely interesting. And I think the DCIS having the similar molecular profile as invasive cancer is extremely interesting as well.
Lisa, can you comment on the fifth subtype?
The normal-like subtype? No. I think, you know, Chuck, I think in his heart of heart believes that those are probably tumors. They weren't well sampled tumors in a sense. They really don't give you an expression profile that fits with the other things. I think they're kind of a black box at the moment. I think most of the people who work with these arrays think they just didn't have a high enough proportion of tumors in the sample. As you know, these are typically chunks of tumor that then get put into the array analysis. So it includes the tumor cells, the stroma, infiltrating lymphocytes, whatever else is there. And if you don't have a strong enough signal from the tumor cells, then you tend not to be able to, they don't fall out in a particular category. And that's where the so-called normal-like group probably is from.
And do we know or have any estimates of what fraction of breast cancer overall falls into these five categories?
We do. If you take population-based studies, we looked at this in the Carolina Breast Cancer Study. The Carolina Breast Cancer Study is a population-based study. However, and this is important to start with, the people who designed it 15 years ago, it was one of our original SPOR molecular epidemiology studies long before I ever got to UNC. The people who designed it, who are from our School of Public Health, recognizing that African-American and premenopausal breast cancer was really underrepresented in most of the data sets, really tried to oversample deliberately in what is a population-based study, but one that has and was designed to have about 50% African-American and about 50% premenopausal breast cancer, because they wanted to try and be able to have the strength and the power to answer risk factor questions within those two groups, which they suspected may be different than, as one of my friends says, you know, modern medicine is a whole lot of information about white middle-aged men. And in breast cancer, I think we have a lot of information about Caucasian women, but really relatively little amongst our minority populations. And then because breast cancer is a disease of older women, premenopausal breast cancer also tends to be underrepresented in our larger data sets. So the Carolina Breast Cancer Study actually oversampled both those groups. It's been sort of a gift that keeps on giving, because it's been, as I say, ongoing for a number of years and has continued to be reanalyzed and analyzed. In this case, we went to the first phase of it, which has about 800 tumors in it, of which we had tumor for analysis and all the demographics, characteristics, and outcome on about 500 of them. In that study, we were looking specifically to see how common, for example, basal-like breast cancer was. But we didn't know about any of the subtypes. And it's sort of a funny thing. The reason I was involved with it was because as we were developing this idea of molecularly distinct profiles, if you wanted to design clinical trials, you kind of need to know how common the profiles are if you're going to try and limit your studies, which I think is a real challenge for clinical trialists in the future. If we recognize that these distinctions exist and that the diseases are different, we're going to have to stop writing trials for breast cancer as if it's one disease. So in order to further that, we looked to see how common the different subtypes in fact were. And what we found were some of the clinical characteristics that I mentioned before, you know, the highly proliferative nature of basal-like, also HER2. We didn't find that certainly the basal-like breast cancer subtype was not different in terms of its stage at presentation, which was a little bit surprising because of its poor prognosis. We might have thought that it would have a higher proportion of stage 2s or 3s, for example. And we didn't find that there was more nodal involvement. We did see more nodal involvement in the HER2 subtype, so that may be part of the poor prognosis of that group. In terms of the patients who get which type, the biggest difference that we saw was in the basal-like subtype. So in general, basal-like subtype makes up about 15 to 20% of the population. However, if you just look at the subgroup of premenopausal African-American women, the basal-like subtype actually was more than double what it is in everybody else. It was between 35 and 40%. It was 39% specifically. So that was a bit of a surprise for us and something that hasn't been explained.
What about the frequency of the other three types?
The other three types were the same across all groups, except again in the premenopausal African-American women, and the only other difference we saw by race and age was in the luminal A category, which is, of course, the best prognosis group, which makes up between 50 and 60% of all breast cancers in general, however, is only about 35% of the young African-American women who get breast cancer.
I want to turn to Jenny now and ask if you can talk about some of the intracellular pathways that have become important in terms of studying both prognosis and response to therapy.
As you know, there are 70 gene profiles by the Vandeveer group that have been prospectively validated in larger studies and that have shown there are signatures that can differentiate patients who are going to do well versus those who are not going to do as well. And there are other profiles for prognosis that are currently available. We touch in part on a different type of platform, but the genomic health assay, the 21 gene assay, that divides patients into low risk, intermediate, and high risk. Now, there have been several large validation studies on these signatures. In terms of prediction of response to therapy, it's slightly more difficult. I mean, obviously, in terms of endocrine response, Dennis DeGroy has published some data in tamoxifen-treated patients, those who are likely to benefit from tamoxifen versus those who are not. In terms of chemotherapy, there have been a few publications in this area trying to look for signatures that could predict for those who respond to various chemotherapy-based regimens. Work done in Anderson by our group have come up with several different non-overlapping gene profiles. But really, in my estimation, it's not so much the individual genes that are important, but the pathways in which they come up with. And I think that that is gene expression profiles and expression arrays are important in learning biology to tell us what's happening in the tumor. And I think that's what the greatest advantage is.
Can you kind of review some of the major pathways that have been studied and defined and how our common therapeutic agents affect those?
By and large, I mean, this is a historical done by both gene expression arrays as well as by traditional methods. Essentially, chemotherapy affects dividing cells and affects the apoptotic pathway. So the two major pathways in which cancer cells grow and divide. So you have increased cell division and cell cycle, and the other one is improved survival. So if a cancer cell basically proliferates and grows because it can beat the death signals and it can grow and divide. And what chemotherapy likes, basically, are cells that divide quickly, and therefore there will be an increase in apoptosis affecting primarily dividing cells. And I think that primarily is what happens with the chemotherapeutic agents.
Can you talk more about exactly what the apoptotic pathways are and how they integrate with other pathways in the cell?
The apoptotic pathway, basically, or the survival pathway, primarily works through the PI3 kinase AKT pathway in part. In that pathway, essentially, there are several upstream receptors and ligands that feed into this pathway. And the FAS ligand pathway, etc., will all feed into this apoptotic PI3-AKT pathway. By and large, chemotherapy is a shotgun approach in affecting this pathway, and the death signals will affect most dividing cells. And that's why you have the nonspecific toxicity with chemotherapy, including alopecia, GI toxicity, etc.
I think Jenny's absolutely right. In general, I think chemotherapy affects certainly the proliferative genes, you know, are the ones that are the most often implicated in chemotherapy responsiveness in a global sense. There are probably some differences, and it may be in some of the pathways she was just illuminating, like apoptotic genes, that may be either general or more specific. And we're getting a hint from that in some of the profiling efforts that have been developed for, I say, profiling in a supervised way for prediction of response to particular therapeutic agents. In a sense, some of those predictive profilers actually probably pick up as much general chemotherapy resistance or sensitivity pathways as they do specific ones for particular drugs. And one of the challenges that we have is trying to find predictive panels for, say, anthracycline sensitivity that are just for anthracyclines or just for taxanes. And certainly Jenny's been involved in a very seminal way in a lot of this kind of work. There was, for example, we've done some work at my institution with a data set from a clinical trial that I ran that finished a few years ago that we had tumor samples on, a substantial proportion of them, that was an anthracycline taxane-based neoadjuvant regimen. At the same time, Chuck had a data set from a completely independent set of tumors treated with a gemcitabine platinum anthracycline regimen. And it turns out that you could develop a predictive model from each of those data sets, but the profile developed on the gemcitabine-based regimen did not predict well our anthracycline taxane-based response. On the other hand, the one developed in the anthracycline taxane-based clinical trial did actually predict, well, a very totally different regimen, which overlapped really only in the receipt of anthracycline. And I think that really speaks to the idea that, and I can tell you that that anthracycline taxane-based profile did, when you look at the ontology of the genes involved, apoptotic genes were clearly very much involved in that and really were front and center. So they may well reflect a more general, at least the ones that came out there, the apoptotic pathways, are more of a general chemotherapy resistance and sensitivity patterning, where nucleoside metabolism genes, for example, may help you a lot more with particular regimens.
I think that the trick here really is, can we find specific portraits that would distinguish different tumors that they can receive specific chemotherapeutic agents? And it's difficult. It is difficult. So we have completed a study now involving about 120 patients who have been randomized either to receive a taxane or an anthracycline. The data is not published, but it is very different. The portraits are very, very different. We have quite a nice robust signature now for taxanes as well as for anthracyclines, and they're different. Interestingly, too, data that came out from MD Anderson, which I think is very interesting, is that they had a profile for taxane and anthracycline combination, and they used the same combination together with Herceptin or trastuzumab, and that could not predict when you added in the trastuzumab. So I think we are in a new area where these profiles will give us some clues as to how the tumor behaves, but I don't think we're quite ready for prime time yet in using this to select the right regimen for the individual patient. But I think we're getting close.
Lisa, can you talk a little bit about what we know about HER2-positive breast cancer, again, focusing on what goes on inside the cell in terms of the pathways that are involved there, the interaction with the ER pathway, and how agents like trastuzumab and lapatinib affects the cells?
HER2-driven breast cancer, in a sense, I think that we're sort of lucky in a sense, because it's not that common that you can identify a single pathway that is so relevant and can be sort of therapeutically targeted even as a single modality. Having said that, I do think of HER2-driven breast cancer in a biologic sense as being at least two different groups. And I think that HER2, certainly the profiles would support that. The HER2-positive hormone receptor negative group is different than the HER2-positive hormone receptor positive group. They both benefit from HER2-targeted treatments, but they are different. In terms of the how does HER2 function, I think we're getting a lot of information about that from the emerging studies looking at trastuzumab resistance and the kind of pathways that are important in trastuzumab resistance. The first group, and I think lapatinib speaks to this, is whether or not HER1 is important in particularly acquired HER2 resistance. I think the HER1, the studies that I have seen about HER1 expression in de novo trastuzumab resistance have not been particularly compelling. They're also not very big ones, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of data yet in that particular arena. The fact that lapatinib has efficacy in patients with acquired resistance to trastuzumab, I think, gives us a very strong suggestion that the HER1 pathway may be implicated in getting around HER2 signaling. And as you block HER2 over time, tumor cells are smart, right? They figure out ways to get around our therapeutic interventions, and they co-opt nearby pathways. And one of the ways you can co-opt is by using HER1. Similarly, you can, instead of borrowing a neighbor to stimulate the same pathway, they also can use a neighboring pathway that stimulates the same downstream molecules. And that's where the IGF-1R data comes from, and Doug Yee has spoken very thoughtfully about this a number of times. It looks like that isn't so much of a co-opting as simply a redundant pathway that's also important in the same, particularly PI3 kinase, AKT, downstream molecules. And whether or not that's something we can therapeutically intervene on is there's fortunately several IGF-1R, largely antibody-based therapies that are entering clinical trials, and we'll know more down the road for that.
Jenny, can you talk a little bit about c-MYC in terms of what it is inside the cell and what we know about it as a predictor, and also TOPO2?
Right. So I think HER2 and the data that's coming out is extremely interesting. So Soon Paik recently presented his data on c-MYC. Bottom take-home message is if you're HER2 positive and c-MYC positive, you do very well with Herceptin-based therapies alone. This was not the result we expected. So c-MYC basically feeds into the survival pathway, and it is an oncogene. So basically what was expected was that if you were c-MYC positive, you actually were supposed to do very badly. But what happened in the adjuvant trastuzumab studies was they found that patients who were given trastuzumab who were c-MYC positive did extremely well. The chance of relapsing if you were c-MYC positive was extremely low. I think it was way less than 10%. So this was counterintuitive, probably because Herceptin or trastuzumab works through the PI3 kinase AKT survival pathway, and somehow c-MYC is synergistic because it affects the same pathway. So that is the unexpected result that came out of that study. TOPO2 is a slightly different story. TOPO2, as you know, is the target for anthracyclines. So the premise in which the studies were done was, are there patients that could be spared anthracycline-based therapies? Because we know that trastuzumab, together with anthracyclines, both adversely affect the cardiac function and cardiotoxicity. So they went into the study trying to find whether there were subpopulations of patients that could be spared anthracyclines who were receiving Herceptin. And the study, which was presented again, I believe, in San Antonio last year, showed that in patients that were TOPO2, across the board, the non-anthracycline-containing regimen was not superior to anthracycline-containing trastuzumab-based therapies. But in the subset of patients that were topoisomerase 2 non-overexpressing, they did as well as those that received anthracyclines. So is there a smart population of topo2-positive patients that would benefit from anthracyclines and the topo2-isomerase 2-negative patients that could benefit from the absence of anthracyclines is something that needs to be studied in future prospectively designed studies. In terms of trastuzumab resistance, Lisa very nicely touched on several mechanisms of trastuzumab resistance, including pan-HER2 inhibition. Do you require a more complete blockade of the HER2 signaling pathway? The IGF-1 story, P10 is also another very important component of this trastuzumab resistance. And finally, mutations in the HER2 receptor itself may actually play a very important role in trastuzumab resistance. A large component of our work also is between the crosstalk between the estrogen receptor and HER2. And there's increasing evidence now that if you block the HER2 pathway, you can actually upregulate ER and vice versa. In some of the studies which Mitch Dowsett and our group has done, is that in patients who have received endocrine therapy, there could also be an upregulation of the HER2 pathway. So there's crosstalk between the two, and this can be another escape mechanism for trastuzumab resistance.
What do we know about tumors switching tumor markers, going from HER2 negative, HER2 positive, ER negative to ER positive, and what can induce that?
Yeah, not a lot. Clearly, there are multiple data sets that have demonstrated that there's a small proportion of tumors that using clinical assays will change their status from ER positive to ER negative, or HER2 positive to HER2 negative, or conversely, to a slightly smaller degree. I think speaking to the kind of thing that Jenny's referring to, the idea that if you block HER2 in a previously hormone receptor negative tumor, can you upregulate the expression of the hormone receptor as the tumor tries to sort of dance its way around our intervention? There's very little clinical data. I'm aware of a small study which was reported, I think, last year, where they did do serial biopsies and patients treated with trastuzumab and saw a small number of tumors that actually did see expression of estrogen receptor, but it's very preliminary. And I'm not sure that our clinical assays are necessarily that well suited for identifying these kind of alterations that might be happening on a more subtle level than we currently can tell. As you know, the quality of our clinical assays, we treat our clinical assays for all of these receptors as gold standards, and they certainly are terrific. But as we all know, even what we clinically use today is not always as accurate as we'd like it to be. And certainly some of the groups looking at better ways to give us improved quantitative assessment of hormone receptors and things like that will give us a little better information than we've had with just clinical immunohistochemical-based assays right now.
I want to shift a little bit towards clinical research that integrates with this translational concept, and specifically the neoadjuvant trials that have been done and are being done. Jenny, where do you see this heading in the future? It seems like we're hearing more about much more emphasis on tissue correlative studies and clinical trials right now.
I think that's absolutely true. I think especially as we're beginning to understand all the different subtypes of breast cancer, we are going to be doing clinical studies in specific subtypes of breast cancer, and we need to do tissue correlates. I think that goes without saying. It's like trying to try trastuzumab across the board in all comers. It would have shown no efficacy. I think that the research community is moving towards a common endpoint in collecting tissue up front in primary breast cancer patients as well as metastatic breast cancer patients. Interesting thing would now be the emerging collection of tissue by circulating tumor cells. And I think that is a very important new area where it would be an accessible area where we can serially sample metastatic breast cancer to see how treatments may change the biology of the tumor cells itself. In a similar vein, I would like to briefly mention the study that came out of UT Southwestern, where they actually saw that HER2 was actually increased. Patients were HER2 negative and the CTCs became HER2 positive in up to 30% of patients who in a very, very, very small cohort of patients actually responded to trastuzumab. I think that we do not know a lot about how treatments may change the natural biology of disease and whether or not, but I do believe that Lisa and I will both say that we need to repeat the biopsies in a lot of patients in order to find the best therapy for them at the time of metastases.
Now, maybe I missed something. And this thing that you just talked about with upregulation, was this as a result of an intervention?
So this is a work that was done by Jonathan Ehr in UT Southwestern. And he basically collected circulating tumor cells. And the patients were actually HER2 negative. And after systemic therapy, the CTCs became HER2 positive.
And what kind of therapy did they get?
Chemotherapy.
Hmm.
And up to 30% of the patients became HER2 positive. And we now, there are several other data sets, some with serum HER2, that show that they can actually switch from being HER2 negative to HER2 positive. These are very small, very, very small data sets. You're talking a very few numbers of patients. But a very interesting, perhaps, preliminary look, the so little that we understand about how the disease may change at the time of progression. Something to just keep in the back of our minds.
Jenny, can you talk a little bit about your research looking at neoadjuvant therapy, what you've done and what you're planning to do?
I think that the neoadjuvant setting is the main advantage is that you can collect serial biopsies in some patients to see how does the drug work, does it get to its target, what are the downstream effects of hitting that target. And so we've done some work with neoadjuvant trastuzumab, and we've confirmed, we were probably the first, and it's been subsequently confirmed, that the AKT PI3 kinase survival pathway is the primary pathway which trastuzumab works. And that is important because it implies synergism with chemotherapy, and as well as the story now unfolding with PTEN and c-MYC fits in very nicely with that being the primary pathway. So that's some of the work we're doing there, and we have now a study on neoadjuvant lapitinib looking at its activity in HER2 overexpressing breast cancer with serial biopsies to see how does lapitinib work and is it different from trastuzumab. Endocrine therapy is another very interesting area, I think, in which we can actually be able to test out new combinations of endocrine therapies in a neoadjuvant setting. In the United States, it's been very hard to do neoadjuvant endocrine studies, primarily based, I believe, on a bias of oncologists that they need to see massive tumor shrinkage over a short period of time. But elegant work done by Mitch Dowsett and others have shown that you can use surrogate markers like proliferation markers measured by Ki-67. And a decrease in Ki-67 in week 4 is actually a very good indicator of long-term outcome. And patients that show a decrease in Ki-67 are those who basically respond to the endocrine therapy. An earlier study, which is the ATAC study, which was a 9,000-patient study, patients were randomized to receive Arimidex or anastrozole versus tamoxifen or the combination of anastrozole and tamoxifen. And a very similar study, which was done in the Royal Marsden under Mitch Dowsett, essentially was a much smaller, several hundred-patient study. And it was called the IMPACT study, which randomized, again, to the similar three arms, Arimidex versus tamoxifen versus the combination. And in that study, Ki-67 was markedly decreased in the Arimidex group versus the tamoxifen group. And the combination of Arimidex and tamoxifen was not better than tamoxifen alone. So basically, had we known the results of the IMPACT study, the ATAC study would have been designed in a very different sort of way. So a much better approach, I think, in the future when we design these adjuvant studies is can we actually add in a component in the neoadjuvant setting, very much like the IMPACT ATAC story. And so we're thinking of doing a study which is now going through the IRB, where we are postmenopausal ER-positive patients will receive Arimidex versus Arimidex plus Faslodex to see whether or not Faslodex can decrease Ki-67. And I believe that this will lead to future adjuvant studies in the same sort of way.
Can you talk about the rationale for combining those two agents?
They work in a completely different way. So basically, Arimidex essentially lowers serum estradiol level. So you're talking about, in a sense, removing the ligand, while Faslodex works by degrading the estrogen receptor. And so if you think about it, it would be rational that the combination thereof would be more effective than either agent alone. And in animal models, especially by work done by Angela Brody, this is indeed the case. This has not been shown in, we have not yet demonstrated this, and there are ongoing metastatic studies in postmenopausal ER-positive breast cancer patients, but the results are not yet available.
Lisa, there's been a lot of work in neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in Europe, but relatively little done in the United States. Do you see that changing?
I do actually see that changing. I think there's sort of two parts of it. One is that the backbone of therapy in the United States, I think, tends to be chemotherapy, and the backbone of therapy in Europe traditionally was probably more hormonally based. I think the fact is that the early hormonal trials reported relatively modest response rates for neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, somewhere in the 50%-ish range, 50-60%, whereas chemotherapy trials were reporting response rate in the 80% range. And so there was a bias that you saw higher response rate to chemotherapy than to neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, which fit into a clinical bias that endocrine therapy tended to work more slowly than chemotherapy. I think as we've gotten smarter, we realize that part of that may be the biology of the cancer as opposed to the effect of the drug, in that there are randomized studies, and Semi Glazov and his colleagues presented an AI versus chemotherapy approach about a year or two ago, in which really you see among hormonally, if you think of it, endocrine receptor positive patients, really modest effect of chemotherapy, and the response rates were not significantly different. We've done some work with this with anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy, and clearly the luminal subtypes have a significantly lower response rate to just AC than either the HER2 or the basal-like subtypes. And the group at MD Anderson has done the same kind of analysis with TFAC. So I think we recognize now that the biology of ER-positive breast cancer is very different, and the response to chemotherapy is very different. I think that gets to also the role of the recurrence score, for example, and some of the kind of ability to try and figure out who within a ER-positive group may in fact be benefiting from the addition of chemotherapy. But from the standpoint of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, I think that there is growing recognition that probably neoadjuvant endocrine therapy optimally delivered is probably about as good as chemotherapy in this particular group. And so some of the bias, the historical bias, I think may fall away.
I want to ask both of you about the new NSABP neoadjuvant trial, the B40 study that's been talked about for a long time and looks like finally it's getting finalized, with three different docetaxel-based chemotherapy regimens neoadjuvantly with and without bevacizumab, with the primary endpoint being pathologic complete response and also study of the tumor specimens. Jenny, what are your thoughts about that trial?
It opens a whole can of worms. I think the neoadjuvant setting, if you want to test something, would give us, in a sense, quick and dirty answers as to whether or not the regimen is effective. However, having said that, B27 was a very interesting eye-opener in that the PFCR rate, although doubled with the addition of taxanes, didn't really translate into a markedly improved overall survival. So we're still grappling, I think, with understanding what our primary endpoint is. Is it PFCR? Is it survival, etc.? But I think it's interesting, and I think it does give us quick answers as to whether or not a particular regimen is at least as effective as traditional regimens. And again, even the assessment of pathologic complete response is difficult. Different centers do it differently. There is no universal classification of pathologic complete response. Do you look at breasts only? Do you include DCIS? How thick are your sections? All these have yet to be standardized. But across the board, I think that the neoadjuvant approach for chemotherapies to see whether or not additional treatments do add something has a role to play.
Lisa, can you comment on the NSABP trial and also the intergroup study that's being discussed right now for neoadjuvant therapy?
The NSABP study, the question of the optimal taxane-based regimen, I think, is a practical one. Certainly a direction I think is important right now, but one that I hope the lots of additional chemotherapy approach is one that I hope we move away from in the future. The bevacizumab question is the obvious one. I mean, bevacizumab has a clear role to play, and certainly in the metastatic setting, and it is appropriate to move to the adjuvant setting. There's certainly a taxane-based regimen combining with bevacizumab early is a valuable thing to ask. One of the things, as you know, we don't know about bevacizumab is really there's no clear ability right now to identify subsets who have a greater or lesser benefit of the drug, which, unless we want to treat everybody with it, we are going to have to develop paradigms to figure out how to select patients for it. I think the neoadjuvant setting is a better way to do that than the adjuvant setting for obvious reasons. So I think it's a valuable way to approach it. There are complications, including an anti-angiogenesis drug in the setting of a preoperative protocol, but those are practical and ones that probably can be overcome.
Jenny, what's your take at the present time on the mechanism of action of bevacizumab and any predictions about what you might see inside the tumor, for example, in the NSABP-B40 study, what they're going to see?
You know, I think that George Schlesch and Kathy Miller have looked extensively in trying to find groups that would or would not benefit bevacizumab. And basically, as Lisa has rightly pointed out, there are no subgroups. I think one of the ways which I would like to see developed in the use of Avastin or anti-angiogenesis agents is perhaps the role of novel imaging techniques, be it PET scans using ligands against neovascularization or even just FDG PET. And I think that this is something that needs to be incorporated into these studies. But, you know, as I understand it today, there are no subgroups that we know of that would particularly benefit or not benefit from the addition of bevacizumab.
Lisa, can you talk about the new intergroup trial that's being discussed?
There's two CALGB neoadjuvant trials that are in development. They're both currently at CTEP being reviewed. One is a trial just for HER2-positive breast cancer, and it is a randomization between everyone gets weekly paclitaxel, and then the randomization is between trastuzumab, lapatinib, or both in the neoadjuvant setting. They all go to surgery then, and then in the postoperative period, they receive dose-dense AC and a year of trastuzumab adjuvantly. That particular trial is designed to sort of expand our understanding of the role of lapatinib and the potential for trastuzumab-lapatinib synergy. The primary endpoint actually is predicated on the idea that the pathologic complete response rate will be higher for the combination than either single agent alone.
Do you think that people are going to wait for data from this study before bringing lapatinib into the adjuvant setting?
No, I don't think so. I think lapatinib is such an interesting drug that the adjuvant trials will be going on concurrently with this, with the neoadjuvant trials. That particular trial will be hopefully run here through the intergroup, and we will collaborate with the European trial that Jose Baselga is running. And we've sort of developed these protocols and talked about the correlative elements of the trials together. Their trial design is called NeoAphrodite. And it's a very similar trial design, really, in all elements, except that their adjuvant therapy is with FEC, and they don't request a year. The adjuvant biologic therapy is whatever you are randomized to in the beginning. So they will have people on that study who will receive a year of lapatinib, for example. But from the standpoint of the preoperative portion of the protocol, they're very similar in design, and deliberately we're trying to dovetail the correlative science component so that each trial can serve, in a sense, as a validation of the other. Again, with the importance of neoadjuvant therapy giving you a glimpse of what will happen in far larger adjuvant trials, but also a lot of information about what's happening in the biology and what groups are getting particular benefit and what's happening in the tumor. The neoadjuvant studies provide a lot of additional information about biology that the adjuvant studies really can't answer. And they give you clinical information, although it's not the ultimate clinically meaningful endpoints of all of these studies, is disease-free and overall survival. And those are endpoints that the adjuvant studies are designed well to answer, not the neoadjuvant studies, which tend to be smaller and more flexible, but designed for endpoints like pathologic complete response, which at best are proxies.
You mentioned that one of the arms will combine lapatinib and trastuzumab, Lisa. What do we know about that combination in terms of side effects, toxicity, as well as efficacy at this point?
Well, certainly from the standpoint of the reason for combining them, there's clearly synergy that's demonstrated in the preclinical models, and there's some clinical evidence that Jenny can probably speak to since she's actually doing a study of this. Whether or not the lapatinib will play a role in not just an acquired trastuzumab resistance, but an a priori synergy of the pathways, I think it really remains to be seen, and in part is the reason for a lot of interest in this particular approach. As I said, de novo trastuzumab resistance, it's not as clear exactly what kind of a role the HER1 part of the pathway plays there. Having said that, lapatinib, of course, is a small molecule, and having a dual HER2 blockade, ignoring the HER1 effect of lapatinib, dual HER2 blockade may well be a better way to go, and that may be what we find. This is a question that hasn't been answered, but is an obvious one to ask neoadjuvantly.
Jen, you were mentioning the study you did with neoadjuvant trastuzumab. Can you talk about what you saw there clinically and what you're seeing right now clinically with neoadjuvant lapatinib?
I would like to continue a little bit on what Lisa was saying, a little bit on the possible synergism between lapatinib and Herceptin. I'll talk a little bit about the preclinical data. There is a lot of preclinical data on the synergism of the combination of the both. In our group, we looked at the MCF7 HER2 overexpressing xenografts, and in these human xenografts, the combination of lapatinib and Herceptin and endocrine therapy, if you're ER-positive, essentially the cancers all went away. You had almost 100% response rate in the combination of just these targeted molecules alone. And that is very strong evidence that, you know, there is crosstalk between these different pathways and that probably pan-HER inhibition is necessary. If you look at the HER2 path receptor family, there are four members, which is HER1, HER2, HER3, HER4. What's critically important is that HER2 does not have a ligand. It must partner. It must either homodimerize or heterodimerize with HER1, HER3. And therefore, it makes sense that if you completely block this, you can increase the efficacy. And that's where trastuzumab, which only affects HER2, cannot do. And therefore, it's a potential escape mechanism. And I think it's probably, in my estimation, one of the more important escape mechanisms for trastuzumab. So in the preclinical data and clinical data, I believe that pan-HER2 inhibition would play a role. In our neoadjuvant setting with trastuzumab, we saw a very high efficacy with single-agent trastuzumab. And a similar thing is being seen with lapatinib, a very, very high response rate. Interestingly, patients who receive lapatinib and Herceptin thereafter have a very high pathologic complete response as well. So in this very, very small study, I believe that it lends evidence to the preclinical mouse models that show that the combination of lapatinib and Herceptin would be an important way in which we can target these tumors.
Can you talk about, Lisa, the other neoadjuvant CALGB trial?
Yeah, the other one is targeted for the triple negative subset, so ER negative, PR negative, and HER2 negative, and that will be led by Bill Sykoff. And it is a randomization to, again, a taxane-based regimen followed by AC with bevacizumab, either added or not. And they will, again, look for pathologic complete response as the primary endpoint. There is a second randomization in the chemotherapy regimens. It's an independent one where everyone receives weekly paclitaxel, but half of the women will additionally receive carboplatin. So it's, you know, the classic CALGB, ask as many questions as you can at the same time sort of design. And the reason for that is twofold. One is in ECOG 2100, the forest plots were reported at San Antonio by Kathy Miller last year. And as you may remember, really, there was no difference along the subsets in terms of benefit of bevacizumab added to weekly paclitaxel. And in particular, in that study, the ECOG study, because it was a first-line metastatic study, there was a de facto exclusion of HER2-positive disease. Very few patients in that study had HER2-positive disease because the study did not include trastuzumab. So if you look at the forest plots, the subset that were all they've reported is on hormone receptors. However, if you simply look at the ER-negative, PR-negative group, you're basically looking at the triple-negative group because HER2-positive disease wasn't included. And if you look at that group, there's a very strong benefit in that subset, which to me says that bevacizumab clearly is the only targeted therapy that we have clinical evidence of a targeted therapy working in, and makes this a very, very good question to ask in the triple-negative subset. At this point, for triple-negative disease, all we have is chemotherapy. So if we can define a targeted treatment for this group, it can only be a benefit. The randomization to platinum or not, I think, as we all know, the additional benefit of platinums in HER2-positive disease, we have two clinical trials. One was positive, one was negative, and I think it is still an open-ended question. But remember that the triple negative type of breast cancer, the basal-like subtype, is the kind of breast cancer that women with BRCA1 mutations get. When they get cancer, it's basal-like, almost always. And there's certainly in the BRCA1 preclinical and even some clinical data that the aberration in the DNA repair pathways that happens when you lose the function of BRCA1 may confer particular sensitivity to platinum-type drugs. And that question, and whether that still holds true in sporadic non-BRCA1 type basal-like breast cancer, will be directly tested in this trial.
Where do you see this all heading?
I think the first thing would be, can we take everyone who's ever done work in predictive modeling for anthracyclines, taxanes, you know, sort of existing drugs, and come up with a paradigm for actually treating patients according to a profile and limiting chemotherapy? You know, so we have this tendency to keep adding drugs and adding drugs and adding drugs. And I think we are now at the point where we can get smarter about giving less therapy as opposed to more. And so my first thought is, it is a very hard sell to get people to not give an anthracycline or not give a taxane, to use just a biologic, for example. We have no studies right now that involve trastuzumab without any chemotherapy. Wouldn't it be nice to not give chemotherapy to some of these people? And I'm not aware of any particularly compelling data that says you have to have the chemo on board for the lower risk HER2-positive breast cancers, particularly those that are also ER-positive. We also don't know how to use, if the neoadjuvant setting tells us, and I have to say, Jenny had made a comment about B27 and how it called into question the relationship between PathCR and outcome. I have to say, I disagree with that assessment. I agree with her that that's how B27 has been interpreted, but I disagree with that interpretation. If we do recognize that response to therapy is relevant for outcome, is there a way of designing trials so that you predicate further therapy on whether or not they responded to the last one? So for example, the MD Anderson and I think it was Gustave Roussy in France, there was a collaborative effort that came out where they tried to develop nomograms predicting response to neoadjuvant therapy. And they came up with some nomograms and they were pretty good. They weren't great, but they were pretty good. And then they tried to apply them to a model which included additional drugs like taxanes. And they worked in some settings. It didn't work in others. And the reality was that when you added a new drug, there was only a group of patients that seemed to respond that got additional benefit. And it wasn't the ones that weren't responding at all. It was the ones that had sort of responded to the first set of drugs but gained all of the benefit in later drugs. And I think specifically adding taxanes to anthracyclines. And I think B27 also saw that the subset analysis suggested that additional therapy seemed to be primarily limited in its efficacy to those groups of tumors that had sort of a PR, you know, only a partial response to the initial therapy. And how do we get smarter about giving drugs if we're finding that some tumors are insensitive to cytotoxic chemotherapy? Then maybe we should go directly to something more novel in them. If we find, on the other hand, that some are only partially sensitive, can we predicate the number of cycles that we use or the addition of non-cross-resistant drugs to those where you're getting some response but not enough? And the last group is, if you get a complete response after two cycles of AC, maybe you can call it a day right there and not give additional therapy. So those would be the big ticket questions that I would love to see answered.
So Jenny, you have a very, very grateful Texas oil family because you've taken care of their mom so well and wants to give you a couple $100 million to do whatever you want with in terms of breast cancer research. What would you do?
Two major broad themes. One is, I believe we're going to come to a point when we will be able to find the individual pathways that drive individual cancers. So the most rational thing is we do away with chemotherapy and select the pathways that affect individual cancers and just block it, siRNA. But we should start with things like what we have, the HER2 pathway, the ER pathway, and angiogenesis, and see whether or not we can design a study that can actually do away with chemotherapy. Because no woman likes to lose their hair and feel sick and vomit all the time for 3 to 4 months. So that's one thing which I would love to be able to do. And I think we're not that far off, and I believe in Lisa and my lifetime, we're going to be able to see that. And the second thing which Lisa touched on is to be able to better, more intelligently predict who would respond, not only to chemotherapy and endocrine therapies, but also to targeted therapies.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.